From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. From the very beginning of Vladimir Putin's presidency, press freedom in Russia has been hanging by a thread. Despite Putin's stated commitment to a democratic media, his Kremlin has imposed censorship in Chechnya, orchestrated legal cases against powerful media barons, and granted sweeping powers of surveillance to the security services. Recently, Russia's last politically independent TV station, TV6, was pushed to the brink of bankruptcy due to a rarely invoked law that many see as an effort to silence the station. Also recently, journalist Grigory Pasko was sentenced to 4 years in prison for reporting that Russia had dumped nuclear waste in the Japan Sea. And these are just the latest episodes in Putin's continuing campaign to control his nation's press. Mike McFaul is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says that the climate for press freedom was chilly under Putin's predecessor Boris Yeltsin, but now it's headed into the deep freeze.
Under the Yeltsin era, there was some harassment. Mr. Pasko was arrested, after all, in the Yeltsin era. But there was a sense that the media was important. Boris Yeltsin defended the media as a principle that it should be free and independent. Under Putin, though, the rules have kind of changed. He speaks formally about we need a free press, but his actions, particularly against Mr. Pasko, against NTV, the national television station that was shut down earlier last year, he's demonstrated that he just doesn't get it, in my opinion, what a real free and independent press is. And people are nervous now. People are scared. You have self-censorship for the first time in a long time in Russia.
You mentioned NTV. Russia's two former oligarchs, media oligarchs as they're called, Vladimir Guzinski and Boris Berezovsky, are now both living in exile after economic and political pressure forced them out of their empires and out of the country. They were dissenting voices in the media landscape in Russia. Now there's only one politically independent TV station left, TV6, and it's facing closure. What's the latest in that case?
TV6 is owned, 75% of that company is owned by Boris Berezovsky, the man you just mentioned who's in exile. 25% is owned by the pension fund of the largest oil company in Russia, Lukoil. And under a very obscure law that finally is no longer valid as of January 1st of this year, Lukoil went to the courts to shut down TV6 because it hadn't turned a profit in 2 years. One court upheld that decision, another one overruled it, and a third just recently overruled that one. This has nothing to do with the rule of law. It has to do with arbitrary use of the rule of law against Putin's enemies.
Well, one of the most devastating effects of the crackdown on the press is the lack of coverage of the war in Chechnya. Has Putin been effective in muzzling that coverage?
Well, he did it most effectively by putting NTV out of business, because NTV in the last war was the television network that devoted the most critical coverage to the first war. By pushing them to the sidelines, he's managed to really control the media. Having said that, it's curious to look at opinion polls from Russia. Despite that, people are learning about the war first and foremost through their loved ones who go to serve there. And his popularity in terms of that policy in Chechnya has been declining. People don't like wars that they don't understand.
Since we need Russia politically right now, do you think the government and even the media watchdogs are cutting Putin more slack than he deserves? Do you think the West is watching Russia's handling of the press closely enough?
Well, I know that the Bush administration is watching it closely. I know the people who are doing it, they're watching it closely. What they're not doing is making it a major issue in U.S.-Russian relations, precisely because we want them on our side for the war on terrorism. We don't want to get into spitting matches about TV6 and the Paskos and Moiseevs and Sutyagins of the world. I think that's regrettable, because I think at a time when Putin also wants to reach out to the West, he very much values the relationship he's established with Bush. That, therefore, gives President Bush leverage to help his friend along, if you will, to help him understand the importance of these things. Now, I'm told that when they met in Crawford, it did come up, it was put on the agenda, but I think without publicly speaking about these things, you undermine those very brave souls in Russia that are still trying to keep independent journalism alive.
Well, Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike McFaul is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and an assistant professor of political science at Stanford University. And he's also senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And now, in recognition that news events sometimes engender opposing points of view, we bring you the first edition of our occasional series, The OTM Spectrum. Today's subject, the CNN promo featuring anchor Paula Zahn, which the network pulled last week over sexism concerns.
Find a morning news anchor who's provocative, super smart, oh yeah, and just a little sexy. CNN, yeah, CNN. Paula Zahn hosts American Morning starting Monday, 7 Eastern. That's right, on CNN.
Bob, there's a spectrum of opinion on this. Why don't you stake out a position?
All right, Brooke, I will. What millennium are we living in? Is it possible that in the year 2002, a news network with such reach and influence could advertise its journalists as sex objects? What is Paula Zahn, a chorus girl? A pin-up babe with a lavalier mic clipped on? To portray her as a little bit sexy is more than a little bit sexist, trivializing the journalistic skills that won her her role on CNN and before that on CBS and Fox. She is diminished by the effort, and CNN along with her.
All right, and now from the other end of the spectrum, Bob.
Thank you, Brooke. Give me a break here, all right? CNN has produced the first entirely candid anchor promo in history, and it's taking grief over it? Paula Zahn is a perfectly serviceable journalist. I've worked with her many times, and she's got plenty of talent. But I'm here to tell you that if she weren't a little bit sexy, she'd be doing something else for a living. There's only one CNN, but every TV news operation under the sun is the Fox Network.
Thank you, Bob. That was irritating.
You're very welcome.
Obsessively attentive listeners will have noted that the sound effect used in the Zahn promo is not, as some have assumed, a garment unzipping. It's a record scratch. It seems that the public appetite for this sound effect does not in any way track with the public's appetite for vinyl records, which, as we know, are practically dead. The scratch is everywhere, as our own obsessive producer at large, Mike Pesca, reports.
In a Bud Light commercial that's currently airing, a young couple walk into a jewelry store and the woman falls in love with a diamond ring. Just as the guy starts to think about how much this will set him back, he is distracted. What's this?
They're fantastic.
Beckoning to him through the window is a beautiful woman holding a bottle of Bud Light. Do you mean me, his gestures say? The beautiful woman crooks a finger. The guy is drawn to her cold-filtered siren song. He can't believe it. This sort of stuff never happens to...
Who's the guy? Who is this guy?
For the great taste that won't fill you up and never let you down.
Oh, no. The woman wasn't beckoning to him at all. The guy is now forced to buy his fiancée a bigger diamond. And the cue that his world was about to lose all color, cut, and clarity? The sound effect, which says, whoa, wait a minute. NBC's promo department seems particularly in thrall of the record scratch.
Tuesday on an all-new Frasier, Daphne's back, and Niles has big news.
We're going to consummate our relationship.
What?
And for Saturday Night Live...
And now something every mother wants to hear.
I was just getting acupuncture on my hoo-ha.
It's the new Saturday Night Live.
Then there's this spot for AT&T, where two teenage boys need a ride home after a Destiny's Child concert.
Hop on in, guys.
And who pulls up in an abandoned parking lot but the band itself?
File this under never. Need a ride?
Come on, kids, get real. Destiny's Child giving you a ride home in their limo, and on top of that, their hit singles being played off of vinyl? According to Record Industry Association of America statistics, vinyl records account for less than 1% of all recorded music sold. But according to Baker Smith, the director of the Destiny's Child ad, commercials use record screeches and scratches like they're going out of style, which, of course, they are.
We always know, you know, at the end of the meeting, we haven't cracked it. Someone goes, well, we can always put a record scratch on it. Like, oh, good job, Bob. Way to go, Fred. Sort of congratulate ourselves, and it's going to be funny now, and move on.
Even after he decides to use the record scratch, Smith still has choices.
There's different ones. There's a rip, you know, there's I feel very passionate about the record scratch.
I mean, it's very rare that I'm writing anything that couldn't benefit from a vinyl record scratch.
John Abood is co-founder of ModernHumorist.com. To Abood, the record scratch harkens to days gone by.
It wasn't uncommon at the turn of the century for a pair of lovers to be dancing to a phonograph in their parlor when the jilted suitor would burst into the room and, you know, rip the needle off the phonograph, and the lover's reverie would be interrupted by this, you know, brutish thug. And that was a classic symbol that carried on into many of our cartoons, many of our commercials. It's part of our collective unconscious.
Abood's jilted suitor scenario supposes the record is a 78 being played on a Victrola, hardly a reference for the average Destiny's Child fan. I asked real live teenagers, Niaja Hoskins and Charmaine Sattler, what they thought the sound effect was.
A recording that just stopped, like, ripping.
What is that sound?
I have no idea.
You don't know what that sound is?
What, a recording stopping?
Yeah.
A recording stopping.
So what would produce that rip?
Oh, pausing the tape or the recording. I don't know.
What about, like, a vinyl record?
I know, I saw it on TV, makes that noise.
Have you ever seen that in real life?
I don't think so.
As a medium moves towards extinction, it leaves artifacts behind. We listen to a dial tone before we dial the phone, even though almost all phones are made with buttons. The record scratch was once an annoying consequence of misusing the medium, but now it's genuine music. When it comes to vinyl, it may be that the only thing that avoids the slag heap of history is the slag itself. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, a gay cable channel, gay commercials, and some very rich geeks.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Larry Ellison, founder and chairman of Oracle Corporation, is a serial liar. Steve Case, chairman of AOL Time Warner, and his brother used to cheat in neighborhood basketball games. Bill Gates, the world's richest corporate tycoon, rocks back and forth like an autistic child. These and other fascinating details are reported in the book The New Imperialists by Washington Post technology reporter Mark Leibovich. He joins us now. Mark, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
Bill Gates, Steve Case, Larry Ellison, John Chambers from Cisco, and Jeff Bezos from Amazon.com. These guys are carved on free enterprise Mount Rushmore. But by and large, these men seem to have avoided the kinds of darts and cruise missiles that tend to go along with being a famous industrialist. Are these men so unblemished? Are they coated in Teflon? How have they managed to manage their images?
All of these companies have extremely tautly run PR machines that, I mean, are very, very tightly controlled. And what so many people in the media, and I'm, as a technology reporter for 5 years, probably just as complicit in and as anyone, is that so many people focused on the gee whiz of new technology and the voyeurism of new wealth that they did tend to define these people in a very shorthand mythology that was well-suited for the internet speeds and the short news cycles that defined that era.
Uncritically looking at some people who deserve to be looked at critically?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have one of my favorite anecdotes was John Chambers, who became CEO of Cisco, I think, in 94, 95. He's a sales guy. Everyone is put on this earth to help him sell or to buy from him. And he did an interview in, I think, maybe 96, 97 with Larry Fisher, a technology reporter of the New York Times. And it was your typical interview in which the PR person babysat the whole thing, and Chambers was very cordial, and he ended all of his sentences with Larry, because he and Larry Fisher were, of course, such good friends. And at the end of the interview, he looks at Fisher and he says, "Well, Larry, it's been a pleasure, and I hope you'll send me a copy of this ad when your story comes out," which I think wonderfully distills the blurred line between what the media was doing and even, on the other end, how CEOs perceive the media's role in this.
A hammer, Mark, thinks everything is a nail, and this is a media show, so let's talk for a moment about Bill Gates' media diet. This is a guy who was in charge of his company's technological side, who was responsible to the board of directors for all matters relating to Microsoft, who's in the middle of a brutal antitrust battle with the government, who runs the world's largest charitable foundation, but he still, I understand from reading your book, has time to read more in a month than most Americans read in a lifetime.
What's fascinating is Bill Gates, for as much as he's been through, is paying as close attention to what the media is writing about him and his competitors as you can imagine. He has incredible encyclopedic recall of seemingly everything written about him or Larry Ellison or anyone he would consider a rival. I mean, this is someone who micromanages his public image, even now, to a very, very minute degree. He spent probably the equivalent of 5 hours just emailing these elaborate responses to my questions that really didn't seem that relevant to anything.
One last question. The new imperialists were on everybody's mind about 2,500 NASDAQ points ago. Is there a possibility you may be too late with this, that some of the bloom is off the rose?
The possibility that I'm too late with this? Well, I'd never thought of that, Bob. I mean, the caveat that goes with any high-tech, you know, writer is that everything can change. And the saving grace here is that I didn't try to write this as a definitive slice of history. I think I wrote it as a snapshot from a revolution in progress. And the good news is these five guys are still essentially monopolists, if not in the legalistic sense, certainly in the sense that they dominate whatever market they're in. And these are the people who are building the virtual world that is changing people's lives even now, as we are, you know, we might have other concerns and we might not be making as much money.
Well, Mark, it's very nice speaking with you, and your ad will run this weekend.
Thanks, Bob.
Mark Leibovich is the technology reporter for The Washington Post, 3-time Pulitzer Prize nominee and author of The New Imperialists: How 5 Restless Kids Grew Up to Virtually Rule Your World.
We heard that cable channels MTV and Showtime are in, quote, serious negotiations about launching the nation's first gay channel. Here to talk about the implications is the man with the scoop, J. Max Robbins. He's also the author of The Robbins Report for TV Guide. Max, you're back.
And it's a pleasure to be back, Brooke.
So, this cable channel, do they have a name for it yet?
We haven't been able to find one out, but they are in serious discussions, both Showtime and MTV. And we may even see kind of a beginning sign of it as early as March.
They're not the only ones in this kind of discussion, are they?
No. MTV and Showtime seem to be the farthest along. But HBO has had discussions over some time about this. And they've also talked about this over at USA Networks. And the parent company of Bravo and AMC, Rainbow Communications, also has looked into this.
So why now?
Well, I think why not now? There's certainly a sizable gay audience, and there's a real thinking that this might make good business sense.
Are there any concerns among the gay community about ghettoization?
Oh, I think there are. And when you talk to people from the gay community, those involved in the television business, the first thing they say is, hey, about time. But the other thing they say is, look, it better be quality. This is a demanding audience. There are also some misgivings, if you will. In reporting the story, I talked to people who said, hey, how are they going to deal with their real different sensitivities among the lesbian community as opposed to the gay community? How's that going to break down?
How do you think they're going to pitch this thing? I mean, Lifetime is television for women.
I don't know. I do know, though, that there is something in Canada called Pride Vision that launched not too long ago. And what they've done is, for example, they've bought the series Will and Grace. Two of the central characters in it are gay. They've purchased select episodes with gay themes from other sitcoms. They bought the Showtime series Queer as Folk. They do news programming that has a focus on gay and lesbian issues. They also, I think, do some game shows that have, I mean, for example, one of the things I heard bandied about for this proposed channel is maybe they'll have a gay dating game. Look, Brooke, over the last several years, we've seen a lot of major advertisers. I mean, from General Motors to Budweiser, who have made marketing pitches directed at both the gay and lesbian community.
We have an interview about that coming up soon.
There you go. I mean, there's a lot of marketing research out there that says there's a sizable gay population. One of the figures bandied about is that 6% of the adult American population identifies themselves as either gay or lesbian. There's estimates about what kind of buying power, and it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars that represents. People in the media business, especially in these tough times, are looking to expand into market segments wherever they can.
You know, it's clear that Lifetime television for women has a lot of male viewers. Nevertheless, with 52% of the population being female, it doesn't really need them. BET has principally a black audience, but that audience is certainly big enough in raw numbers. I mean, once you get down to the gay community, it may be sizable in terms of the population, but in terms of a slice of the viewing audience, it really isn't all that great. Can this channel succeed without the straight audience?
I think it'll need to cross over somewhat. But look, you've got networks out there. There's a Speed Vision, which is about race cars.
I stand.
Auto racing, yeah.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, come on, Brooke. There's the Golf Channel. I'm not a golfer, but it seems to do okay. That's one of the things that's going on out there. You have this incredible channel capacity, and there are audiences to support just about anything you can imagine.
Max Robbins, succinct as usual. Thank you very much.
Brooke, pleasure as always to be here. Thank you.
Max Robbins writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide. Larry Gross is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of the recently released book, Up From Invisibility, Lesbians, Gay Men, and the Media in America. His main concern about the proposed new channel is that it will most likely be a pay service, hard to find, and possibly unavailable to the audience that needs it most.
The people who I think most benefit from these programs are people who are isolated and vulnerable and for whom media images are, you know, almost a lifeline of support. This is in particular young people who are growing up and coming to terms with an identity as lesbian or gay or transgendered in families that may not know or support this identity, with friends and schoolmates and teachers who don't know or wouldn't be supportive, and for whom the media can literally become the only source of some kind of solidarity and connection.
Well, we heard Max Robbins say that, my God, they have cable channels devoted to golf and they can support them. But golfers don't generally worry about being mainstreamed. Are you concerned about ghettoization for gays and lesbians if they have their own channel?
No, not really. I think it's very important to have specialized programming, you know, what you might call a voice of your own or a place of your own. That's the kind of cultural format that gay people have really never had, except in the gay press. But the gay press is a pretty small phenomenon in terms of the potential audience. I think where the problem is going to be, it's getting the talent to participate in something which agents and managers and others will view as a threat to career possibilities. You know, if you take Queer as Folk as an example, which is the closest thing to what they're talking about, there are only two openly gay actors in that entire cast. All the others are not only heterosexual, as far as I know, but all of the publicity about the program has made sure you know that. And if you take prominent cases like Sean Hayes, who plays Jack on Will and Grace, he goes to extraordinary, even somewhat ludicrous extremes to let you know that he's not letting you know what his sexual orientation is.
Professor Gross, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Larry Gross is the Saul Wirth Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the recently published book, Up From Invisibility, Lesbians, Gay Men, and the Media in America.
The presence of gay characters on television is not limited to the programming. Increasingly, in depictions both positive and otherwise, homosexual characters and issues are finding their way into advertising as well. Journalist Michael Wilkie has cataloged these efforts on a website called commercialcloset.com.
Mom, Dad, if you're watching, I want you to know I finally found the person I want to spend the rest of my life with. Mom and Dad, this is Jen.
Hi.
Show your colors, Mystic.
Mike Wilkie, that is a pretty extraordinary thing to see on your television, even in, well, in this case, the year 2000, is it not?
Well, that's actually an older commercial from, you know, several years ago. You know, it ran on MTV, and its audience is a more progressive, younger audience who, you know, really isn't all that concerned with the idea of gay or lesbian people as being an issue. It's sort of a non-issue for that age group.
Isn't it also true that while there's quite a number of depictions of gay characters, even gay lead characters in television, primetime television programs, for example, that advertising has kind of lagged in that respect?
It really has. And what's true about my entire archive, really, and even though most of it has happened, let's say, in the last 6 or 7 years, most of it has only shown in pretty limited arenas. It will have been on MTV only, or it may just be in a couple of cities like New York, San Francisco, and LA or something. And they run briefly and then they're gone. And so a lot of people really never see them or even knew that they happened.
Historically, how was homosexuality, or at least the suggestion of homosexuality, depicted in television commercials?
Well, it was more often just a reference. It wasn't actually depicted directly. For example, a 1989 commercial from Kellogg's for its Nut and Honey cereal has this question, you know, asked of various people, and you know, it's supposed to be a joke response.
What'll it be?
Nut and Honey.
Ooh. Just stop by to see me, huh, sugar?
So it has these various vignettes, and in the last one, it's always the last one that this happens in, there's a chuck wagon scene with a bunch of cowboys around a campfire or whatever, and there's a male cook there. And so they come up and ask him that question.
Hey, Cookie, what's for breakfast?
Nothing, honey.
And then they all pull their guns out on him, you know, threatening to shoot him for presumably calling them honey.
They felt their masculinity threatened by being called honey.
Exactly.
When did the commercial closet first open? Was there a moment of creation?
Really, I'd say 1994 with IKEA was a critical turning point in terms of awareness and then interest level in inclusion of lesbian or gay people in commercials.
Let's listen to a little bit of that commercial.
Well, you know, we went to IKEA
because we thought it was time for a serious dining room table. And
we have slightly different tastes. I mean, Steve's more into country. It frightens me, but at the same time, I have compassion.
We've been together about 3 years.
I met Steve at my sister's wedding.
But yeah, it was really a groundbreaking advertisement. It was the first time that anyone had included a gay couple in a non-humorous way. They were meant to sort of depict reality. And it showed two men shopping together, and frankly, it was such an unusual idea at the time that it made news around the world.
All right, now tell me about gay vague advertising. You identify on your website and have in your writing talked about ads that to one audience may seem perfectly innocuous, yet to a gay audience have some sort of hidden message.
Well, there are different motivations that can happen in the gay vague category. Sometimes it's actually an effort on the part of the advertiser, I believe, and other times I think it's more accidental. Now, a perfect example of perhaps an accidental one is Volkswagen's Da 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 commercial. Has two guys driving around aimlessly in a car on a Sunday afternoon. That commercial debuted on the coming out episode of the Ellen program, where she told everyone she was lesbian. And so it had a very big gay and gay-friendly audience watching at the time. When it came on, everyone sort of looked at each other and thought, are these two guys supposed to be boyfriends? And even though there were no lines in the commercial, there seemed to be a little je ne sais quoi about it that seemed to imply that. Now, Volkswagen said, we didn't intend for them to come off as gay, but it's okay if you want to think so.
There's this old joke about the guy in the psychiatrist's office, and the psychiatrist is showing him Rorschach ink blots. And the guy describes, as he looks at these blocks, one in a long, you know, in a succession of, you know, erotic images. And finally, the psychiatrist says to him, well, you know, Mr. Jones, it looks to me like you have some sort of obsession with sex. And the patient replies, well, you're the one with all the dirty pictures. Michael, are there really gay, vague ads, or are you just seeing dirty pictures and ink blots?
No, because there are some also that are more intentional, in my opinion. In fact, when I was at Ad Age, I wrote about Parliament cigarettes ads. They have this campaign that's, of course, a long-running campaign in the mainstream media, which has a man and a woman in an exotic sort of seaside locale. And in gay magazines, what they've done is they've added another man into the picture. And one time, they actually took that extra step and made it just two men and their dog. After I wrote about it, though, they ended up pulling back. Someone later came up to me who had worked with Parliament, basically said to me that the company was upset after I wrote about it, that I had revealed what they were doing to the mainstream audience out there.
You outed them.
I outed them.
Michael Wilkie, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Michael Wilkie is the creator of The Commercial Closet.
Coming up, one cartoonist goes to Afghanistan to save the world, the other goes to the public to save his strip.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In last week's New York Times Week in Review, I was astounded by a political cartoon. In one panel, we see an ovum sporting an American flag. The caption reads, Felicia Patterson hasn't even been born yet, but she'll be raped by a prematurely released mental patient so the rich can get their tax cut. And the ovum says, sure, it's inconvenient, but we'll never defeat terrorism unless we have the right budget priorities. That's unusually strong stuff for the times, but standard fare from syndicated cartoonist Ted Rall, an unabashed left-winger who recently traveled to Afghanistan so that he could offer more informed pictorial rants on our war on terrorism. The trip turned his ordinarily sour perspective positively acid.
The truth is, I wanted to go to Afghanistan and see for myself what things were like and to see to what extent we were being lied to and told the truth. My interest in Central Asia goes back a long time. I've been out to that region four times before, and I've tried to get into Afghanistan numerous times before, and even under the Taliban, things were so unstable that it was impossible to get in. So ironically, now that there's this sort of war tourism going on for journalists, it's a rare opportunity to get in, although, of course, it does involve some meaningful risks.
Well, when you arrived in Afghanistan, you immediately hooked up with other foreign journalists. But as a cartoonist, did you feel like an outsider?
Well, they didn't really know what to make of me, and it really had less to do with me being a cartoonist than the fact that I wasn't chasing down every little pinprick story that these other guys were chasing. I was there to find out how things were for ordinary people as the result of our war.
So you came in with attitude and you went out with attitude. How did your attitude change?
Well, I'm not going to lie. I was scared to death. I was in a convoy with 45 journalists total, three of whom were killed, so 42 of us came back. And really, from the moment that I entered the country to the second that I left on the barge with the coffin of one of the three who were killed, I was terrified. And in that respect, my attitude did change to one of utter humility. At the same time, I also found myself becoming incredibly more cynical than I already was before I left, in that I expected, for instance, some mistaken bombings of civilian targets, when in fact there was wholesale carpet bombing of entire cities and districts that had been firmly in Northern Alliance hands for weeks. And in my view, the United States and its allies were more interested in leveling Afghanistan completely than in running any kind of sort of precision war, as Rumsfeld would have us believe. And at the same time, I was kind of disgusted with the local Afghans for viewing us as walking money bags and trying to rob us and kill us for our money, simply because we had it. When we were the only people who were going to be their advocates and tell the truth for them. And there was just nothing was like I expected it.
How did you translate these experiences into your cartoons?
It's hard to convey how going to a place and doing research translates itself to cartoon form. Some people emailed me and said, you know, I couldn't tell from your cartoons that you'd actually been there. Other people said they could. And I sort of know it because I have a real true sense of what at least my part of Afghanistan looked like at a certain point in time. And one of the great criticisms I have of political cartoonists in general is that we tend to just read the paper and react to the headlines and then spew off an opinion. So generally, I don't do a lot of foreign affairs cartooning because, you know what, I never went to Kosovo. I've never even been to the Balkans. So what do I know about it? All I know is what's being reported, which is doubtlessly being spun.
What has the reaction been in general to your work post-Afghanistan?
Of course, I've been catching a lot of abuse since September 11th for being so-called, quote-unquote, un-American, which, of course, means left of center.
But no big change?
Well, you know what? The change is probably isn't really that noticeable to me for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm not on staff at any papers. I'm a syndicated cartoonist. So no one editor can ever fire me. And in essence, I don't get a lot of pressure from my subscribers because the papers who buy my cartoons know that I was always an ornery, cantankerous pain in the butt for the 10 years that I've been selling them my cartoons. They buy my cartoons because I offer a different point of view from mainstream political cartoons. They expected a different point of view and they got it. So the big difference has been to be demonized by major media outlets like The New Republic and The Wall Street Journal. Also, what's interesting is that the people who are opposed to my coverage seem to have taken a different tack than they used to. In the past, it was really common to write a letter to the editor of a paper and say, okay, I'm going to cancel my subscription. I can't stand this guy's cartoon. Now, they write to the advertisers of that newspaper and ask them to pull their product placements from the newspaper unless the newspaper cancels my cartoon. They've become savvier, but also they're really into silencing people's voices. And also, I've got to say, I've never collected such an awesome array of death threats.
Syndicated cartoonist Ted Rahl. You can find a link to his cartoons on our website at onthemedia.org.
Since the 1960s, when his creation Zippy the Pinhead first appeared in the city's alternative weekly, cartoonist Bill Griffith has hefted his pen in San Francisco. Zippy became a daily strip in 1985 at the urging of the San Francisco Examiner, which would be the first of 200-some papers attracted to the strip's satirical skewering of society, especially the consumer society. Then, a year ago, Zippy and his alienated alter ego Griffy picked up another 500,000 potential readers when the San Francisco Chronicle subscribed. But a recent readers' poll at that paper resulted in the cancellation of the comic, along with Marmaduke and Family Circus, leaving Griffith to incite readers to write the Chronicle, demanding their daily dose of subversion.
You would think a newspaper would value such a thing. Newspapers are supposed to value both ends of the spectrum. Controversial columns and comic strips are usually what make editors happy, and I think I fill that need pretty well.
There are always new features coming along, new strips, new talents, and periodically newspapers find themselves going through this culling process. What would you suggest that newspaper editors do when something has to give? How should they go about it?
What I wish they would do, rather than try to accommodate the lowest common denominator or the popularity contest way of figuring out who your readers are, I think editors should just respect the variety among their readers and think of comics as being for different groups, not that each strip has to appeal to the widest possible audience. Zippy appeals primarily to a younger, dare I say it, hipper audience, who tend to be more educated and dare I say it again, more affluent, and I would think newspapers would value that.
Let me read you something that was in the Baltimore Sun. It describes Zippy as, quote, a richly cultured enthusiast for American industrial sculpture and architecture of the first half of the 20th century. To those who recognize the metaphoric fullness of his projected personality, Zippy is an embodiment of the nostalgic zeitgeist of Americans befuddled by postmodernist obscurantism. And, of course, I've always said the same thing. I'm pretty sure
It means he likes Zippy. Zippy, together with Griffy, which is kind of like, the Abbott and Costello of surreal pop culture criticism, they embody one person, which is, I guess, has to be me, in my love-hate relationship with America and everything about America. Zippy loves everything he sees. Griffy hates everything he sees. And somewhere in that dialogue between them both, I hope some sort of satirical picture of America emerges, and I would think newspapers would value that.
For the listeners who are not familiar with Zippy, if Zippy is about anything, he's about raising his eyebrows at the commerce that so drives our society. Okay on that?
Yes.
So what the hell are you talking about demographics and age and income and trying to, how can you of all people?
I'm trying to talk newspaper language.
But haven't you monster that Zippy comments on day after day?
Well, I'm asking the San Francisco Chronicle to recognize the to hold two opposing thoughts in their mind at once. One being Zippy is weird and bizarre and who gets it and what the hell is it all about? And on the other hand, Zippy appeals to a younger, more affluent and ultimately desirable demographic.
Zippy must live because he is subversive. Zippy must live because
he brings in advertising. Yes,
I'm sighing only because the cluck makes a funny sound in the microphone. If there were a real Griffy, he would obviously be very upset about this turn of events. What would Zippy say?
Zippy would primarily be, I think at this point, amused by Griffy's reaction and pretty much ignore the whole hurricane swirling around him.
Which I guess proves that at long last, Bill Griffith and Zippy are not one and the same.
You got me.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bill Griffith is the author of Zippy the Pinhead, appearing daily in newspapers around the country, albeit not the San Francisco Chronicle.
In the current extended season of HBO's Sex and the City, one of the lead characters, Miranda, is expecting a baby. Her delivery will undoubtedly be a much-promoted final episode climax. There's some irony in that particular show deciding to use this familiar TV plot staple because television's treatment of sex has become more realistic than its depiction of birth, On the Media's John Solomon explains.
New York City OBGYN Dr. John Snyder has delivered more than 1,000 babies, so he tries to avoid seeing the procedure when he's at home.
I don't like to watch a lot of television, and I especially don't like to watch a lot of doctor programs because every time I turn on the television, somebody has a baby.
But one Thursday night, his daughter wanted to watch ER, so he agreed to make an exception. Plus, she correctly pointed out, babies aren't delivered in the emergency room, except in this episode.
What's going on in here?
I intubated. Baby went bad.
The whole episode was about a woman who came in and they kept her in the ER and they gave her Pitocin in the ER. She wound up having a shoulder dystocia so that the shoulder got stuck when the baby was born. They had to push the baby back in, which is a maneuver that I have read about, forgotten the name of it because I've never seen it.
It's a damned mess. What'd you use, a chainsaw?
Well, I couldn't just stand around waiting while that baby died.
I don't know whether the baby survived, but the mother died, and it was just a horrific episode. And all my patients who were pregnant seemed to have seen it. A number of them called extremely upset about what they saw on television and were worried that, you know, could this happen to them?
Perhaps no aspect of life is depicted so often and so unrealistically in television dramas and sitcoms as birth. An overwhelming majority of parents responding to a special online survey conducted for On the Media by BabyCenter.com agree. 96% of 6,626 respondents said they have never seen a realistic birth on television or believe TV is way off on realism. And 40% of those surveyed said television had an influence on their idea of childbirth before they experienced it themselves. To Snyder, an attending OBGYN at New York University Medical Center, this misleading impression can add unnecessary anxiety. But he also fully understands why television needs to take major creative liberties to fit its dramatic and comedic requirements. His activities on a recent afternoon emphasize why the normal rhythm of the birth process does not fit the narrative of fiction TV. As on-call obstetrician, Snyder sits in a small, spare room with a bed, desk, and computer, just off the delivery room. He has been listening to a History of the Civil War audio tape, returning phone calls, and reading medical articles on the internet. This waiting game is not part of the job he expects ever to see in prime time. Of course, television is not known for its rigorously accurate depictions of other aspects of life. However, since its own inception, the medium has had a particularly difficult time with the birthing process.
Childbirth was something that happened somewhere off in a quiet place that we never saw.
Robert Thompson is the director of Syracuse University's Center for the Study of Popular Television.
Every single time in the 1950s and into the 60s that a woman would come to the hospital to have a baby, she would disappear, be whisked away, and the next thing we would see is this charming, cleaned-up baby, usually in the arms of a nurse. After all, breaking water, dangling placenta, screams for anesthesia, this was hardly the stuff of an entertainment environment, which in the days of Lucy wouldn't even allow you to say the word pregnant.
That changed in the early 80s as television began to experiment with more gritty realism. Writers and executives were eager to challenge almost every TV taboo, except one.
Language continued to go places it had never gone before. All the rest of the content continued to evolve and to open up further. But to some extent, presentations of childbirth, realistically, have remained relatively few and far between.
Those unrealistic presentations are not all nightmare scenarios like the ER episode. Often, things go smoothly, a little too smoothly. Last week on NBC's Providence, a woman gave birth to a baby in the back of a bar. The entire process, from first contraction to mother's arms, took under 4 minutes. As depicted, it would have set records for speed of birth for a first child and for cleanest delivery ever. There was no umbilical cord to cut. The mother's hair and makeup stayed nicely in place.
The girl.
fact, of those BabyCenter.com respondents who said TV had an influence on their perception of childbirth, a majority indicated that television made the process seem easier and faster than it turned out to be. That's especially true of the typical take on births offered in sitcoms. In fact, Dr. John Snyder thinks sitcoms help loosen up prospective fathers. That was one of the objectives of Eileen Heisler, co-creator of the NBC sitcom Three Sisters, when she wrote a birth episode last year.
I think probably a lot of husbands, I don't know, you could tell me, feel surprised. Probably a lot of husbands prepare for cravings and being screamed at. You know, I think we've all seen where the woman is grabbing the husband's arm and saying, "You bastard, you know, shut up, you know."
Heisler modeled the episode after one of her own deliveries, but she acknowledges some compromises for television, including a desperate rush to the hospital and a hysterical dad-to-be.
Help! Help! Oh, we're having a baby here! Anyone? My wife is having a baby!
It was in the delivery room sometime between contractions when Heisler realized that total verisimilitude was not going to cut it.
I mean, in my labor, personally, being a comedy writer, I was always kind of stepping out during it and thinking about what I could use later, but sort of a surge of excitement, oh my God, we're going to have the baby. And then it was just like waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And it was like, okay, you know, the audience would have long left by now.
Syracuse's Thompson surmises that television's motives may go beyond just higher viewership.
It's almost as though television has done what many human beings do, which is to try to forget the fact that ever since that fated day in the Garden of Eden, we bring children into this world with great pain and suffering. All I've got to think is this has something to do with the preservation of the human race.
Of course, network execs also know that without the human race, ratings would surely fall. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke.
It's a damned mess. What'd you use, a chainsaw?
We had help from Allison Lichter and Jim Colgan. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.